This morning, we continue our series in the Gospel of Mark. We're calling this series, Meet Jesus, Follow Jesus. And it's our desire that we would meet the true Jesus, to see him as he truly is. But not only that we would see him, that as a result, we would follow him. And so this morning, we continue that journey. If you want to look with me to Mark chapter 2, we're going to start in verse 23. And the section we're looking at this morning actually represents the end of a section within the opening of Mark where we've encountered four controversies. Am I really loud? That seems really loud. I'm the voice in your head. Okay. But we're going to look at the last of the four controversies. So as we've seen the last few weeks, there's been something that's happened, something that Jesus has said and or done that the powers that be have not liked. And the question is whether he's right. Can he say that? Can he do that? Is that true? And so far, in every category, the answer has been yes, Jesus is correct. Yes, Jesus has that authority. Yes, Jesus can say that, do that. So we had the paralytic, whom Jesus healed and forgave his sins. And the question was, can Jesus really forgive sins? And he didn't just forgive this man for something he had done against Jesus, but he gave them this existential kind of forgiveness, just this declaration over his life that he was forgiven. And everyone was shocked. Who can say that? And then in working the miracle to follow that, Jesus confirmed that, yes, he does have the authority and the will to forgive sins. Then we saw Jesus associating with sinners, infamous characters, and people questioned it. Is this proper? Can he do this? And the answer was, yes, he's come for those who are sick. That's why he came. And then last week, we saw this question about fasting traditions and how his disciples, his students, don't fast. They don't follow the traditions. They don't follow the devotional literature of the day. They don't fast twice a week. And the question was, does Jesus really warrant that kind of celebration and joy from his disciples that they don't observe these fasts? And he compares himself to a bridegroom and the people of God to the bride. Is he really at that level of identity? And the answer was yes. Now we come to the fourth and final controversy in this section, and it's about the Sabbath day. The Sabbath day. Now I'll warn you again, like previous weeks, we got to get into the backstory a little bit to understand what the controversy is about. What's the tension about? So we're going to talk a little bit about the Sabbath, but we're going to see what does Jesus do? What does Jesus say? And again, like the other controversies, this is going to help us meet Jesus. We're going to learn a lot about him and about his ministry from this controversy. So let's read just the first couple verses that kick off the scene and the situation. Mark 2, starting in verse 23, and we're just going to read two verses and we'll pause. Verse 23, one Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields, and as they made their way, his disciples began to pluck heads of grain. And the Pharisees were saying to him, "Look, why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" All right, so this is our opening scene. They're walking through a grain field. The disciples are a little hungry. They pluck a head of grain, break it up, munch it a little snack on the go. And the Pharisees are scandalized by this. And they say, why are the disciples of Jesus doing something that's not lawful? If this guy is a good guy that we should follow, why don't his disciples do lawful things? Why do they break the law? What's going on? That's our tension. Why are they so upset? Did they break the law? Why are they so worked up on this little bit of rubbing grain in their hands and munching the seeds? Why are they so upset? This is the backstory part. To understand the tension we're walking into and what Jesus is about to say, we need to understand a little bit about the Sabbath as it comes to us in the Old Testament. The Sabbath was a 24-hour day of rest. It would have started on a Friday evening at sunset. That's when they marked the close of a day, the beginning of a new day. And would have ended at sunset on Saturday evening, 24 hours later. And the Sabbath was important. It was anchored in the rhythm of creation. The story of Genesis tells the story of God creating the heavens and the earth in 6 days. And on the seventh day, he rested from his labors. It wasn't the rest of tiredness, but the rest of completion, the rest of doneness. That looks good. I'm going to stop here. That kind of rest. And so we're told that seventh day, that Sabbath day of rest, was holy and special because it's built into the very rhythm of creation. And then as we see the people of God forming in the nation of Israel, one of the top 10 laws of the land is number 4, keep the Sabbath. It's really important. It's a solemn observance. It's a weekly observance. It makes the top 10. It's reflective of the character of God. It's a big deal, and they want to get it right. But if you read through the Old Testament, you find out that one of the things that Israel doesn't do is observe the Sabbath. So even though the command is as simple as take a day off, 1 in 7, on the seventh day, take a break, take a rest, even though that's the command, we see in various places where the prophets show up to bring a charge against God's people, we see that they haven't done that. They were greedy for gain. They were eager to make money. It's hard to stop for a day. You have to trust the Lord in that. So they wanted to just keep on working, keep on going. So it's a big deal, but it's neglected. And it's one of the transgressions that's cited when they get kicked out of the promised land. They didn't keep the Sabbath. So the Sabbath actually becomes even more important when they're in exile. When the Israelites go into these foreign lands, into Assyria, Babylon, it becomes a big deal because the Sabbath day travels. So they've left the temple, they've left Jerusalem, some of these powerful, visceral symbols of God's blessing and presence. They don't have that anymore, but they have the Sabbath day. A recent rabbi, Abraham Heschel, has famously referred to the Sabbath as a sanctuary in time, a temple in time. It's a way in time to set aside something, to have a temple, to have a holy place. And so in exile, the Sabbath gets even more significant. It becomes a key marker of their identity. And sure enough, when they start to return to Israel, when the Jews start to come back to the land, guess what one of the big emphases is in the land? Let's keep that Sabbath. We learned our lesson. Let's not go down that road again. Let's keep the Sabbath. And one of the books that records a return, Nehemiah, we read Nehemiah saying, "Then I confronted the nobles of Judah and said to them, 'What is this evil thing that you are doing, profaning the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers act in this way? And did not God bring all this disaster on us and on this city? Now you are bringing more wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath.'" I want you to hear the tension here. This is what we did in the past that landed us in exile. Why are you doing it again? And we're told that Nehemiah sets up guards to the market to keep out people who would be selling and buying goods. I mean, if you could imagine troops being set up on either end of Turkey Creek, that's what Nehemiah does. He sets up troops because they want to get the Sabbath right. It's a big deal. And then you have this 400-year period between the last prophet and the arrival of Jesus. And in these 400 years, there's no prophet, there's silence. Now think about how all that goes together. They want to keep the Sabbath holy. They want to get it right. But there's all kinds of questions about how to do that. And in fact, it's gotten more complicated than years before because you still have some Jews living in exile, the diaspora Jews. You have some that have returned to the land, but they're not in charge anymore. The Greeks and then the Romans are occupying and directing the affairs of Israel. So how do you keep the Sabbath when you're not in charge of the law of the land anymore? So there's all these questions. How do we do this? What if this happens and that happens? And so what begins to emerge is a huge body of literature around how to keep the Sabbath. How do we do this? So put all that together. 400 years, no prophetic voice. 400 years, all kinds of additional complications. 400 years, a greater emphasis and importance on the Sabbath. And so the Mishnah refers to the literature that develops around the Sabbath is a mountain of literature hanging by a thread. There's actually not that much in the Old Testament about what to do and how to do it, but there's mounds of literature. Okay, so now that's the scene. That's the tension. So you need to hear when the Pharisees are getting concerned about Jesus, and could this guy be the Messiah? Well, I don't know. Look what he's doing with the Sabbath. He could really mess things up for us. He could get us kicked out of the land again. He could get us in trouble with the Romans. I mean, it seems like they're really worried that Jesus could be leading the nation in a wrong direction. And so the issue, look back at that, those first two verses, 23, 24, what's the issue? It's that what they're doing is unlawful. Now, the word unlawful there, it doesn't mean outright breaking the law. Now, this is an important point. It doesn't mean outright breaking the law, but what they're doing is not consistent with the law. It's not lawful. It's not proper. It could be breaking the law indirectly. Let me give you an example. This is what we have in our courts all the time, right? Is we have some law on the books, and then some example, something happens in the real world that nobody anticipated when they wrote the original law. They do this, and people say, well, does that count as breaking that? And then the judges have to give a ruling on what that is. So maybe the rule is no parking in front of Hard Valley Academy in the fire lane. That's the rule. It's on the books. But then you say, well, I wasn't parking. I mean, I was in the car. I mean, I had my foot on the brake. The engine was running. I wasn't breaking that law. And that's the question. Was it unlawful? Was it consistent with the law? We call that standing. To be standing at the curb, does that break the law of no parking in the fire lane? And then somebody would have to rule on that. That's the tension here. It's not that they're outright breaking Sabbath laws. The question is, have they done something that's inconsistent with the law that we know about? And the law in question is Exodus 34, 21. Here's the clear command. 6 days you shall work, but on the seventh day you shall rest. In plowing time, so as you're preparing, and in harvest, so as you're reaping, you shall rest. That's the law. No harvesting on the Sabbath. Even if it's in the middle of this great bumper crop, you still got to take a day off. You have to take a day off. So the question in this passage, the tension is what they did, does that count as harvesting? Is it unlawful in that sense? It's just not proper? It's not consistent with the Sabbath law? Or is it? That's the tension. That's the backstory. All right, now. Let's read the whole thing, okay? So we're going to see what Jesus says in response. And we're actually going to read right into chapter 3 where we get a real-world example of proper Sabbath observance. And what we're going to do here is we're going to learn a lot about the Pharisees about Jesus and about his ministry. So let's finish this controversy off as it starts back up here in verse 25, and we'll go right through chapter 3, verse 6. The response, verse 25. And he, Jesus, said to them, "Have you never read what David did when he was in need and was hungry? He and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God in the time of Abiathar, the high priest, and ate the bread of the presence, which it is not lawful for any but the priest to eat, and also gave it to those who were with him. And he said to them, 'The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath.' Again, he entered the synagogue, and a man was there with a withered hand. And they watched Jesus to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man with a withered hand, 'Come here.' And he said to them, 'Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm? To save life or to kill?' But they were silent. And he looked around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, and said to the man, 'Stretch out your hand.' He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. And the Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him, how they might destroy him." So what do we learn here as we close out the tension? Have they done what's unlawful? What's going on? What can Jesus do? What is the proper understanding of the Sabbath? Who are these Pharisees? Well, the first thing is we learn a lot about the Pharisees in this section. And this is important because we're just going to keep bumping into them. And really, the religious leaders in general. And we find out in this section that the Pharisees are pretenders. And we would do well to beware of experting, which I'll explain more in a minute. But in this section we just read, we get who the Pharisees really are. You know, I told you as you walk through the Old Testament, you think through some of the tensions they're feeling, in those first two verses, we might give the Pharisees the benefit of the doubt. There's a lot of gray on this question of Sabbath. There's a lot of good questions about how to properly observe it. There's challenging circumstances at this time. So maybe this is just one of those good questions. Why are they doing what's unlawful? This is a genuine question. Well, we find out here, it's not a real question. They don't care about the answer. They're pretenders. Jesus calls them hypocrites, actors. They care more about trapping Jesus than honoring the Sabbath. What are they wanting to do in verse 2 of chapter 3? What does it say? They're watching him. Why? So that they might accuse him. That's the heart of this question. Accusing him. And the word there for accuse is like a technical legal term. The idea is that they're looking to bring a lawsuit against him. That's more of the wording. They're looking. Is there something we can catch him on and sue this guy over? Get this guy out of our hair. Get this guy in trouble. Run his name through the mud publicly. So they're not really interested in the Sabbath at all. They're interested in trapping Jesus. And we see they're not even willing to acknowledge a simple, simple truth as Jesus describes the Sabbath. What does he do? He gives them this softball question. He makes it super easy by giving them two extremes, right? You're supposed to know clearly what the right answer is. Is it right to to do harm on the Sabbath or to do good? To heal or to kill? He's making it easy for them. But they're silent. They won't acknowledge the point. This reveals their heart. And it says that Jesus, at this point, when he gives them this little underhanded softball question, I'm going to help you out, guys. Work with me here. When they're silent, it says that he's angry and grieved because of the hardness of their hearts. And that's the issue, is that they have hard hearts. The sense of hard hearts is their hearts are impenetrable. They're not soft or supple or green or limber. They're concrete. They're not interested in learning. They're not interested in listening. They're not interested in hearing what Jesus has to say. They're not interested in the proper interpretation of the Sabbath. They are closed off. And Jesus looks with grief and frustration at the hardness of their hearts. And then we see the irony of all irony. You know, they're wondering, what's proper on the Sabbath? What works are proper? Is it okay to pluck grain and eat that? Is it okay to heal on the Sabbath? And there is mounds of literature on these questions. But what do they do on the Sabbath? Verse 6 of chapter 3, they plot to destroy Jesus on the Sabbath. The irony. They're pretenders. They have no interest. And by the way, bonus, they plot with the Herodians. I mean, they just gave Jesus a hard time about being around sinners and tax collectors. The Herodians? I mean, that was like this secular group, and they're conspiring with them to kill Jesus on a Sabbath. So they reveal themselves as pretenders. Now, I don't want to make too much of this, but I think this is a good reminder for us to be aware of experting, as I'll call it. Now, I don't mean experts. I actually think true, good experts are really helpful, and I'm thankful for scholars who, you know, translate the scriptures. I'm not fluent in Greek and Hebrew and Aramaic. I'm thankful there are people who geek out on that stuff and read ancient texts and study literature and vocabulary. Thankful for true experts, well-meaning experts. But experting, right? This kind of pretentious show of expertise. It's just a reminder to be careful with that. To be wary with those who are flexing, as it were, their religious muscles. We'll see in the Gospel of Mark as we continue. You'll see it in other Gospels. You'll see it in the book of Acts. You'll see it in the epistles. One of the big ongoing problems for the church is actually the experting religious folks. It's the religious folks. They cause so much trouble. Jesus will again and again have to address this thing. So that's why it's important here that as we bump into the Pharisees and really get their heart revealed in this scenario, that we realize this is disingenuous. This is not people who are earnest in following Jesus. And this is just an ongoing problem. Paul will say to his young protege, Timothy, beware of these kinds of people. There's a lot of people who swerve from the truth. He uses the distinction between stewardship versus speculation. But a lot of people love to get into speculation when what we've been given is a stewardship, caring for something that's definite and real. But people love to get into the gray. They love to get into between the lines and speculate. And he says people love to assert all these things about the law, and they have no idea what they're talking about. And he warns his protege, be careful. He says a lot of people have wandered from the truth into vain discussion. They've wandered from what's real and true and eternal and living into vain, meaningless, vapid discussion. Beware. So for us who would be listening to these would-be experts, these experting show-offs, there's a caution here for us, right? that we would be mindful. Are we drifting into vain discussion? Is this helpful? Jesus will comment that this kind of thing tends towards burden creation. One of his frustrations with the religious experts is that he says that they just heap up burdens to put on people's back. That's the result, right? All these mounds of literature about certain Bible passages, what's the result? Well, if you're a humble student trying your best to follow along, you're just weighed down with all the to-dos. 25 ways to parent better, 10 ways to have a better prayer life, you know, and on and on and on. Maybe even well-meaning, but the result is you're like, I've got all this stuff that I've got to do to follow the Lord. And Jesus gets frustrated. That's what so often happens with these experting types, just piling up burdens and not willing to help. And then for those of us who might drift towards it, I mean, myself included, I enjoy getting into some of the particulars, right? There's a caution for us. This kind of experting, this kind of speculating, it leads into this vain discussion, into meaningless stuff. It drifts away from the truth. It takes us away from our mission. Paul says the aim of our charge is love. That's the point of all this. And so if we are those who are bent a little bit towards these kinds of discussions, we need to be cautious. I heard a pastor once say that, you know, if you could imagine what we do with Scripture, if you could imagine that through the lens of just a parent asking their child to clean their room, right, it would go something like this. The parent says, hey, I need you to clean your room. And the child comes back a couple days later and says, I just want you to know, you know, I've been meditating on that a lot. You know, just hiding in my heart. Great. You know, did you clean your room? No. Not a big deal. Doesn't have to be perfect, but you can clean your room. Come back a couple days later. Do you know the etymology of clean? Did you know this? It's actually a Latin word. It's actually related to orderliness. Yeah, I've just really been geeking out on this. Did you clean your room? No, not yet. Okay, well, it's not a big deal. I don't want you to overthink it. Just, if you can clean your room, that'd be great. Come back a couple days later. How's it going? You know, I've just been thinking. I mean, what is clean, really? You know, I mean, you ever thought about that? It's complicated when you think about it. You know, what is clean? You know, I was thinking about that, like, internally, you know, culturally. There's just so many layers to it. That's what we can drift into, is it not? Now, again, I want to be careful here because I really think God blesses the church with experts and scholars, and I'm thankful for those, and I've benefited from those. But we just need to beware here of this drift as we listen, as we participate in these discussions. This is so often what happens. This is so often the case. So to be careful here. So in a world where everybody's peddling a book and a conference and a blog and a podcast, just to beware, are these people teaching Scripture, seeking to adhere to Scripture, be conformed to Scripture, or are we getting into this kind of experting, awkward flexing, etc.? All right, so that's what we learned about the Pharisees. What do we learn about Jesus from this response? Well, we see that Jesus is the ultimate religious authority, and we need look no further. It's really astounding in this passage how many claims to religious authority start to pile up from Jesus. First, we see him claiming authority over all these rabbis I mentioned, right? In this 400-year span between Malachi and Matthew, all these people are writing, all these religious scholars, and just in his response that he does not accept the answer or interpretation of the Pharisees, he essentially is pushing back on all that and saying, let me tell you what the Sabbath is really about. So Jesus is claiming authority over hundreds of years of tradition and scholarship, the equivalent of ancient academia. But it keeps piling up. Then what does he do? He compares himself to whom? Somebody else did something similar to this, where they went into a holy scenario and took bread. He implies that he has kingly authority by comparing himself to David. Now, the story he's talking about here is David is on the run. He's been identified and anointed as king, but he hasn't yet been installed as king. So you could imagine it's kind of between the election and the ceremony of coronation here, right? So we're in this intervening time, and the sitting king, King Saul, is out to kill his rival. And he's hunting down David. And David, on the run, not a lot of options, heads to the tabernacle, and he takes this holy bread that was set apart to the Lord, to honor the Lord, and then the priests could eat of it. And he's given the bread, and they eat of it. And nowhere in the Old Testament is that condemned. No, is there any pushback on that? It's accepted as that. That was a fine thing that in one sense wasn't the law, but in another sense was consistent with the law. And Jesus says, if David can do it, I can do it. That's what he implies. If David can do it, I can do it. Now that's huge, okay? Because David is the first proper king of Israel. Saul was a disaster. He was the first king, but David's the first true king. David is the one from whom the Messiah is supposed to come, and the Messiah is supposed to be the son of David. The promise of the Messiah is spoken to David. So you've got kingly overtones and messianic overtones, and Jesus says, if David can do it, I can do it. I've got Davidic authority. I mean, this is huge. So he's claiming this king-level authority, this messianic-level authority. I can do it too. But if that wasn't enough, we get the crescendo in verse 28. What's the crescendo of this passage? The Son of Man, which we've already encountered that phraseology, that's Jesus referring to himself. The Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Now again, that's why I gave you the backstory, because that ought to land with a thud, like, whoa, that's heavy. The Sabbath, a reflection of the creation and the rhythm of God in creation. The Sabbath, one of the top 10 commands, number 4 on the list. He claims to be boss of the Sabbath. This is audacious. He claims the right to define, interpret, and reinterpret the Sabbath. So if we were sitting there with this crowd, our jaws would hit the ground. Lord of the Sabbath? Who is this guy? Who is this guy? And then what does he do after that? We see another scene on a Sabbath day in the synagogue, and he works a miracle. And oftentimes, the context of the miracles is very important. We talked about this with the paralytic. Jesus makes some audacious claims about forgiving his sins, and then he works the miracle after that. And the clear implication of that order of events is that if you work a miracle, God must be with you. That was the thinking. We saw that in the Gospel of John. The man born blind says, how can you not know who Jesus is? Everybody knows God wouldn't work or bless through a sinner and a fraud. So if he can heal me, clearly the Lord's with him, okay? So when he healed the paralytic after forgiving him, it confirmed that it was true, that he could do that. Now what do we have? We have him saying some audacious, over-the-top things about the Sabbath, claims to be Lord, claims this Davidic messianic authority, and then works a miracle on the Sabbath. And that tells us, okay, I guess he's right. The Lord wouldn't bless with a miracle like that if he was a liar and a fraud. So Jesus shows himself to be the ultimate religious authority. He shows that, yes, he can talk like this. He can reinterpret like this. He can define like this. And the miracle confirms that. Now, we've seen Jesus' authority in different categories. So we've seen him healing bodies. He has authority over the human body. We see him casting out demons. He has authority over evil spirits. He's going to calm storms. He has authority over nature. And here in particular, the question is religious authority. He has religious authority to interpret, to define, to reinterpret. So when I say look no further, I mean look no further theologically. Jesus becomes this breakpoint in the story of Scripture. So as Christians, we do believe the Old Testament is relevant and God-inspired, but it is now relevant to us in a new way. Why? Because Jesus has the authority to define and interpret and reinterpret, and that's what he does. He defines the Sabbath. In the Sermon on the Mount, he will walk through the law and define their true meaning. He'll clarify the intent of marriage. He will say that his kingdom is not of earth. Therefore, we don't need swords, and it's no longer a nation state. He has that authority. We could trace that kind of authority back to moments like this. We'll see a little bit later in Mark that he declares all foods clean. He can do this. He'll in Luke 4, he picks up the scroll of Isaiah, reads from Isaiah 61, and he says, "This is fulfilled today." He has that kind of authority to say that prophecy is done. He'll say, "John the Baptist is the Elijah to come." That's his authority, and he will impart this authority to his apostles. His apostles were his individually selected, authorized representatives, and they'll carry on this work. The apostles will also declare foods clean. The Jerusalem Council will help sort out what the Gentiles do when they come in. Paul will talk about the law after the cross in Romans and Galatians. He'll redefine the meaning and significance of circumcision, other observances, and on and on and on. And it's important because that's how we get here. That might seem a little technical, but that's important. How do we get from Old Testament observance to now how we live as Christians? Because of moments like this where we realize Jesus has the right and the authority to reinterpret all of that, to define it for what it really meant, or to properly interpret it. Okay, we got to go faster. All right, skip that last part. Last thing, the ministry of Jesus we find is a ministry of rest. I said we're going to learn in this passage something about the Pharisees, something about Jesus, and something about his ministry. And what we find from this passage is that the ministry of Jesus is a ministry of rest. And I would invite you to enter that rest today. Now, this topic of the Sabbath is too big to get into just in terms of its application today. But what's crystal clear from this passage, Jesus says the Sabbath was always meant to be a blessing. It was given not as a burden, but a blessing. And that says a lot about the Lord, about his ways, about what he wants for us. So the Sabbath was a blessing. Jesus says in verse 27, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. You all have made the Sabbath a burden, is what he says to the Pharisees. How could you have done this? You've completely inverted the intent of the Sabbath. It was to be a blessing. It was to be for man, not man for it. And he confirms this with the healing. So on that Sabbath day, when he heals the man with the withered hand, a deformed hand, he's answering the question is, okay, so what's the meaning of the Sabbath? What's consistent with the Sabbath? What on that day would be fitting with the Sabbath? And the answer is, healing this dear brother is completely fitting and consistent with the Sabbath. It helps us understand the Sabbath was to be a good thing. And what's interesting about this healing, by the way, is that this is a non-life-threatening healing, all right? So there were all kinds of rules and things about what you could do to help somebody on a Sabbath, and you could administer first aid in a true emergency, right? But you were supposed to just stop there. I mean, just get them kind of triaged, and then we'll come back to you tomorrow. Or if there was something going on that just wasn't life-threatening, that it could wait, you should wait. That was the tradition that had developed around the Sabbath. And Jesus clarifies this by saying, I'm going to heal somebody with a non-life-threatening thing that could have waited till tomorrow. I'm doing it today so you'll understand what the Sabbath is about. The rest of God, the peace of God, the harmony of God, the blessing of God is not stingy. It's overflowing. It will heal this thing that could have waited. It won't wait. I want this brother healed. I want this brother restored. And we're doing it today. Don't you see that this is perfectly consistent with the meaning of the Sabbath? So the Sabbath was a blessing. And that says a lot about the Lord, right? This is what his ministry is. This is what he wants for you. His ministry can be described as a ministry of rest. You know, a verse that we often quote because it is such an encouragement is the verse where Jesus says, "Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden. Take my yoke upon you. Take my burden upon you." Why? Because my yoke is easy and my burden is light, and you will find rest for your soul. That's one way of talking about salvation, is finding rest. The writer of Hebrews will make this connection. He'll talk about salvation in terms of rest. He'll say the Sabbath day was never about just the Sabbath day. It was always pointing to this eternal rest in God. The Sabbath day was always a sign pointing to an invitation for us to enter into that seventh day rest. So God is at rest. He creates, and from this perfect world, he stops. Because why? Everything's done when he creates it, right? Everything's perfect. There's nothing left to do. He rests, and we are invited into that rest. And the day was, yes, a gift in time, but also always pointing us to this greater rest. So I don't know each of you personally, but I know this about all of us. We're weary. We get tired. We try. We strive. We fail. We say we'll never do that again. And then we do. And we can come into a morning like this. We can proceed into a week ahead of us with our heads down, beat up, worn down, feeling hopeless. And I want you this morning, as we talk about meeting Jesus, I want you to see the Jesus who gets angry and grieves for those who would make his rest a burden. Why? Because he longs for you to enter his rest. And I invite you this morning to see a Jesus who wants you to find rest, who wants you to enter the harmony and peace of his seventh-day rest, that wants to invite you into an eternal rest with him. So for those who are worn out, beat up, who view church as this burdensome to do, hear today the correction from the one who can make the correction. "Find rest in me," he says. "I wanted you to find rest. My ways are ways of rest. My commands are an invitation to rest. Will you enter that rest this morning?"